If you want to learn more about what we talked about on today's episode, go to the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. All right, this is Nature Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. We're back this week for part two with of our interview with Keith Swindle, former special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. If you tuned in last week, you know that Keith was working on an important case in Hawaii involving the Newell's Shearwater and a petrel, the petrel listed as endangered and the Newell's Shearwater listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And just as we wrapped up last time, he was telling us that he landed in Kauai and basically embarked on a 10-year criminal investigation to determine whether or not any wildlife laws had been violated with regard to the take of shearwaters. And just another brief refresher, these shearwater birds, it's difficult for them to take off. They often take off from high places in Hawaii. And in the fall, the chicks make their initial flight at night, and they're often distracted by bright lights, confusing it for the moon or stars, and that causes them to crash into the land before they make it out to sea. And that can result in tens of thousands of birds losing their lives, essentially being taken under the Endangered Species Act. So welcome back, Keith. Thanks for being back for episode two. You're wearing the same shirt, so everybody knows we recorded this on the same day. We're just splitting it into two. But thanks for being back.
I appreciate it.
All right. So just as we ended our last episode, you were about to tell us that this took 10 years, okay? So we know you arrive. Your goal now is to start documenting things to what you've described to me before as a law enforcement standard, right? You're going to start documenting what's happening to these birds to a law enforcement standard. What does that look like? Tell us about, like, how do you go about this launch?
Yeah. So because most of the fallout of these seabirds occurred during the new moon of October, and then again in the new moon of November, but for 10 years, every October, I would go over to Kauai, you know, because I lived on Oahu, and then I would spend essentially sunset to sunrise looking for shearwaters and petrels. And I would drive the entire island, you know, drive all the whole road system. And there were what we called hot spots. Conveniently, what even the people that managed the hotspots referred to them as hotspots because they knew that, you know, this is where all this happened. And those places were a couple of spots where power lines were aligned without in a way. So one way to describe it is if you imagine power lines going down the road, you know, if they were arranged like a volleyball net, in other words, you know, vertically. Yeah. So if you have like six lines and there's one and then another one above it and another one above it all the way up, kind of like a net. That was one area. Actually, it's called Kealia Beach on Kauai, where that was a hot spot. And it was a little valley that came right to the ocean. And this net of power lines crossed that valley right at the mouth. And so it just funneled. It was a natural funnel, and the birds would fly through there and then they would clip those lines and go down.
Doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that that's going to catch birds, right? You don't have to be a biologist to know that birds are going to follow the wind pattern down a valley and come out right at the mouth of the
valley. Yeah. Yeah. So consistently every year I would find more birds there than I would find in other places. And that's why we called it a hot spot. And then there were these, that one had no lights. The other problem were areas with unshielded lights.
Okay.
And you know, this whole process, so like, let's say there were three football stadiums on the island.
Okay.
Basically three high schools that used facilities, and those would be big attractants on Friday nights, you know, because they would
Friday
have these
night lights.
big stadium, exactly. Big stadium sized, you know, lights, and those lights were unshielded. And that's what I could see from the mountains. It was 8 miles away. I could see those lights like a beacon.
Wow.
You know, they were the brightest thing out there on a moonless night. And if there was a moon, they were as bright or brighter than the moon, you
wow.
know?
Okay.
So I would go around and find birds, and most of them were either, well, you know, they're either alive or dead. If they were alive, I would collect them and take them to the SOS thing, or even go release them at night.
Okay.
If I was in a good place for it. I had to be careful about that because the attraction of light is so strong in these things that if you took one and you let it go at the beach and it flew out to sea, as it's out on the ocean, if it's a moonless night or a new moon,
right,
if it's flying around and then it sees a big light on land, it'll turn around and come back.
Oh,
you know?
Man, that must be depressing if you saw that. Huh?
Yeah, yeah. So I often didn't release them for that reason. What I would do is then take them to that whole SOS, Save Our Shearwaters kind of mailbox at the fire department kind of thing.
Right.
And then release them in the morning, you know.
I see.
But I would GPS, the original location. I would photograph it several ways to show, to illustrate if it's usually near a light, you know, illustrate the light, get an overall shot, get a close-up for an ID, GPS it, do all the, you know, who, what, where, when sorts
yep.
of things.
You're documenting
and
what type of lights there too, right? Like whether it's shielded, unshielded, all of that.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And then plotting all that, ultimately plotting all that on maps and things like that. And then figuring out who the owner of the light is. And on Kauai, this is important. On Kauai, the non-private lights were pretty much generally two owners. The street lights were the power company on that island. They managed and maintained the street lights on the entire okay. island. And then the other public lights, so like, you know, county public buildings, the football stadiums, which were like public schools, some tennis courts, some soccer fields, some baseball fields, things like that, was the county of Kauai. So those were essentially the two entities with the majority of the lights that were causing problems.
Okay.
And then, of course, the power company also maintained some of the power, you know, all the power lines. So I spent 10 years of Octobers at night
working the night shift, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oof, brutal.
And, you know, not that complicated, but pretty straightforward, not technically not that difficult, but just, you know, had to be very thorough.
And that's hard on, you lived in Oahu, right? And so
that's hard
on personal life, personal relationships, if all of a sudden you disappear for days, weeks at a time to work nights.
Yeah,
that's rough. You know, when you're working long nights, you're doing this all by yourself, which, you know, in any other agency, they probably would have assigned half a dozen agents to go over and work on it. But did you have help from like the public?
I certainly had allies, you know, in terms of groups that were interested in saving the species, the biologists, things like that.
Okay.
But, you know, as you probably experience in your career, you know, you're kind of a pariah, right?
because sometimes you're the hero, sometimes you're the pariah. Yeah.
Exactly. Because that's always depends on the day and the moment, right?
Mm,
even with the same person, because When I'm out there kind of being the lightning rod of initially, and remind me to come back to this, but it started off like an antagonistic sort of relationship, with the violators. After 10 years, it ended up being great, really almost a partnership, even though I was charging them criminally.
Okay.
And I'll try to explain that more. So I did have others out there, and what I would try to do is get them to collect information like I did, that could be used, and if and ultimately perhaps they would testify. But I knew that I had to get the main thrust of it, that was going to be if we ever had to charge. I needed to have that, that evidence documented in to an evidentiary standard.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Do you ever run into any odd characters out there in the middle of the night?
I some of my best intel was some well, there were some homeless folks, and then there were some just folks out on the park bench because they were drunk and their wife didn't want them at home.
They
And
became good
and you
sources of information about where the shear waters were coming down.
absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I learned a lot from one of those guys. He told me that when he was young, this guy I met outside of one of these football stadiums, he was out. I think he was in that category of his wife didn't want him at home that late at night with that kind of breath. And and he said that when he was young, they used to have to stop the football games because there'd be so many birds landing on the field.
Whoa.
So these birds would circle, 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 and then end up exhausted, and then would land wherever. And there were so many that they would actually land in the field of play, and they would have to stop the game and like shoo them off, or not shoo them off, but pick them up and move them off.
Wow.
So that kind of speaks to, when I was doing it, we were finding just a couple hundred a year.
Okay.
But back in 1979, they were finding as many as like 2,500 a year, just in a couple week span.
So by the time you took over the football situation, it would be maybe one or two birds a game would come down, whereas this guy was telling you
Yeah, and
before
they
it
might.
had stopped in the game.
And when and like so one or two birds a game would come down, and they might come down a half mile away from the game, even though they're circling it. Or they might come out cut down in the parking lot or something like that. Or sometimes in the stands or on the field, maybe one bird. But he used to say, we would have to stop because there'd be so many birds.
Wow. That's actually one of those weird,
Which
that's one of those weird indicators. It's like non-scientific, but it's definitely
Yeah.
it's what we call in the detective business a clue that the population is decreasing, right? Crazy.
And basically we were humanity, was mining these birds from the sky, I mean, over time. And
Interesting. What about you told me a story once about some school bus driver was
oh
involved.
yeah. Yeah, I was out well after midnight. I remember I was at a traffic circle, a new traffic circle on the island of Kauai, and I saw a car, what I thought was either a live bird or a carcass across the way, and I parked my car on the opposite side of this traffic circle. I was just going to walk over and do my thing, photograph it and all that kind of stuff. And a school bus, like an old style yellow school bus, big long bus, comes driving along at, like at 2 a.m. or something, maybe 12:30 or something like that. And I see the bus driver is this, middle-aged woman. She gets out and she picks up this shearwater and then takes it into the school bus. And then I was like, well, first, I was like, well, dang, she's getting my evidence.
Yeah, so he's picking up your evidence.
I went over and talked to her. Yeah, and I went over and talked to her, and then basically, as I recall, I took the bird from her. I mean, we had a really nice conversation, I just wanted to know more about her, and she's like, "Yeah, I'm driving this. You know, I'm the bus driver, and I was moving this bus for some reason. I don't remember why." And she saw the bird, and you know, was going to pick it up and take it to the fire station. You know, just wonderful citizen, you know.
Right.
So I told her what I was doing and all that kind of thing. And then, you know, so this wasn't like an enforcement sort of contact at all. But, you know, another story, Ed, is I remember you and I exchanging stories. You had once told me you had a foot pursuit, and I was so jealous of that. So one night I'm driving down this road real late at night, you know, again, somewhere in the midnight or after hours. And all of a sudden, I thought it was a jar, like a mason jar full of milk, is what I thought it was, because it hit the windshield so hard. And I was going like 40, 45 miles an hour. And it came out of nowhere. I didn't see it, but it was just like this bang, an explosion. And I literally thought the windshield was going to be cracked. You know, it was so loud. And at the In a second, the whole windshield had a white, you know, liquid over it. Like, it just was white and almost blocking the whole windshield. And
Wow.
I pull over, and I look, and I see up on this little kind of hillside on off the side of the road, I see two people take off running, you know.
Oh.
So I jump out of the car and I go in my foot pursuit, man.
All
I
right.
am chasing these two guys. We're jumping things. We ran through a construction site and we're having to leap things and all this kind of stuff. And then they run through this kind of like little doorway of this construction site, or it was like one property to the next, and it had I had to you had to jump through the doorway. Like you there was like a foot of like lower wall or something that you had to jump through. So I jump through and I turn left and I'm chasing this guy. And then I see him run under a street light. And I'm like, I think this is a kid, you know? And so I keep running, and all of a sudden the guy, which I at the time I thought, gets tired and he sits down on the grass on next to the sidewalk. And so I get there and I'm just, you know, I'm almost doubled over heaving, you know, and he's just sitting there, you know, calmly. And it's this kid that's about 14 or 15. He was a big kid, you know, I mean, he was like as big as me, but he's about 14 or 15 years old. And you know, I had done the whole police and stop and all this kind of stuff when I was running. And
Wow.
so I get there and I said to the kid, "Why didn't you stop?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I wanted to get away." And then I said, "Is this your parents' house?" Because what he did is he ran and he sat down on the lawn next to this, you know, on the sidewalk. And he
Yeah.
said, "Yeah."
Oh my God.
And he, I think he said, you know, "Please don't tell him," or something like that, you know. Well, I said, "Well, what did you throw?" You know, and it
Right.
was an egg. And I mean, I couldn't believe it was an egg, you know, because like I said, I think it was just because I was going like 45 miles an hour and they threw it at it. And
Right.
then, you know, the egg white just, you know, went white
Right,
as soon as
right.
it spread out. And so anyway, I just said, "All right, come with me." And we walked back to my car, which was like 3 or 4 blocks away. And then I made him, there was a hose attached to the
Nice.
school, so I made him wash my windshield.
Nice.
And then I was talking to him, you know, he said, "What are you doing here? And why did you throw it?" And he said, "Oh, I thought you were my friend's brother, you know, because I had a similar car or something." But anyway, that was my big, exciting foot pursuit.
That's your foot
Nothing
pursuit.
compared to yours.
the egg throwing teenager. That's still a good one. That's still a good one, in part because you handled it perfectly. You know, that's the kind of lesson a teenager needs, because you know what? For all the teenagers listening out there, never throw an egg at a car because it might be a federal agent driving by at that moment.
Yeah, right.
And I'm telling you, if it's a Fish and Wildlife agent, we will pursue you. We will catch you. That's hilarious. That's a classic example of like how different stuff happens to you when you're out working on a case.
Yeah. Well, and then the great thing about it was, you know, while I'm making him wash my car, he's asking me, you know, who are you and what are you doing? And I told him everything. You know, I said, I'm over here, you know, picking up shearwaters and all that kind of stuff. And he said, oh yeah, okay. And you know, so we had a really nice, a nice visit.
Yeah, that's cool. But,
anyway, back to
That's cool. You definitely educated somebody that night. So back to shearwaters and petrels now. So during this 10 years that you're working on this case, you're documenting what's happening. You're like, as you said, to an evidentiary standard. You know, a lot of times, as we talked about earlier, people think federal agents are often characterized by bad guys always, but heavy-handed, you know, not thinking, robots who move forward and take action. But really, yes, you are documenting what's happening. But during this 10 years, tell us what were you doing to try to, were you working with the potential violators, these two power companies in Hawaii?
Yeah.
What does that look like?
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a power company and then the county government. And almost from day one, you know, I mean, as soon as I actually had like my first understanding that, this is actually a violation, I contacted both the county and the power company. Most of the early dealings were the power company, and which it was initially it was Kauai Electric, but then they became a co-op and it was Kauai Island Utility Cooperative. And you know, I was approaching them with basically kind of the consequence in my mind at that time was a civil penalty or a civil proceeding if we had to get there, you know, if they didn't comply. So I worked with them for 8 years on that. And, you know, they took the normal kind of tack of, again, back to our quote, without enforcement, you know, the law is just advice. Well, with the threat of enforcement, that threat's got to be real or they're not really going to comply.
You know, 100%.
And so, what they did is they would, and then, you know, they had high dollar attorneys, which I wish in hindsight, I wish we could have dispensed with those right away. And we could have just gotten down to brass tacks and fixed the problem. Right. Instead, you know, their attorneys basically look for the ways to do this the cheapest or to get out to do is just enough to make me go away, you know? And then eventually, you know, they realized I wasn't going away. So they had to keep doing more. And then they just wouldn't get over the bar and actually comply with the law and do what it took to comply.
What sort of mitigation or what sort of things were you trying to get them to do?
Yeah. So I'll tell you what they did do over like 8 years, which is a lot, you know, so initially, they shielded all over 3,000 streetlights on the island.
Wow. Okay.
Which was essentially every streetlight on the island for the most part. And they replaced and shielded those. I'm not sure exactly. I don't recall how they did it. I don't know if there was a federal highway project involved in which, you know, which means that maybe tax dollars did the actual thing, you know, did the most of the costs of things. But, you know, nevertheless, they replaced the lights with shielded lights, which was a great first step.
Right.
I let them know of an opportunity and they spent $80,000 to eradicate rabbits that had been released on an offshore islet off of the island of Kauai that other seabirds nested on. And these rabbits denuded the island. So there was a project that some biologists with the state were doing. If they had the funding, they could basically eradicate the rabbits off that island, which were invasive, you know, released there by the Coast Guard like 100 years before. And kind of destroyed the vegetation of that island. So they funded that, and that island to this day, I believe, is free of rabbits, and the vegetation's recovering and all that kind of thing.
So the idea there is you're going to create
They
alternative nesting sites, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like mitigating their take by improving conditions for seabirds somewhere. Because the ultimate goal and the way to comply with the Endangered Species Act is through what we call a habitat conservation plan that minimizes and mitigates the take of the illegal take. They also gave some money to some offshore island, other offshore island conservation projects. When I say offshore, I mean not the main island of Kauai, but other islands near the main islands, uninhabited. They funded some research on protecting colonies, because where these seabirds nested, cats would get in and rats would get in and dogs would get in and kill them in their nest sites. So we experimented, or they experimented, and they funded, supported experiments on that kind of stuff. That one beach where the volleyball net I described to you occurred, they
With the wires.
lowered the lines and then they made them horizontal. They put cross bars on and made them horizontal, so fewer lines to intercept. I'm looking at a list of things that they did.
But these are
Yeah, surveys
things
to
they did kind of at your urging, like, coming in saying, "Hey, I'm a special agent with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm investigating the take of these birds. These are some things you guys
yeah.
can and should and do immediately to reduce the number of birds you're killing," right?
Yeah,
So
exactly.
basically,
And
I gotta say, this gets me, because this happens a lot with cases that are handled by fish and wildlife agents, where we do work
yeah.
with industry, we work with individual people, so especially when it's an Endangered Species Act violation, to try to reduce or stop the damage that they're causing before we ever get to criminal case, right? And it's not uncommon what you
Yeah.
did. I mean,
Yeah.
you did
Yeah.
exactly what most agents will do. We don't walk in and say, "Hey, you're under arrest, we're charging you." Obviously, sometimes that happens
Right.
with the hardcore violators. But if it's an industrial thing, or a take situation that can be minimized that wasn't intentional to start with, we don't come in heavy-handed.
Yeah.
We only come in heavy-handed when people
Yeah.
do not cooperate.
Yeah, exactly. And so all of this time they're doing these things because their argument was that they're doing these things to basically buy time so that they could develop a habitat conservation plan to actually comply with the law.
Got it.
So while I'm talking to them, they're also having negotiations with Fish and Wildlife Service biologists to develop a plan that would mitigate for all of their take. But I'm still kind of like, I'm not pleased. I tell them, we could write a plan today. Why is it taking 4 years or 6 years or ultimately 8 years? And so they were doing these things essentially to appease me, to kind of keep the threat of actual enforcement at bay while they just delay, and especially in Hawaii, when I came from the mainland, right? I'm not native Hawaiian, and I wasn't born in Hawaii. I used to be told to my face, "Well, you're going to be gone in 2 years,"
They're going to wait you out.
and so exactly. So I wasn't. I stayed for nearly 20 years, so basically what we ended up doing, and enter some fantastic attorneys. I need to give a call out to Carolyn Lown, who was a solicitor with the Department of Interior, and then Eleanor Colborne was a Department of Justice prosecutor, criminal prosecutor. Eleanor is the reason that this all really happened. I mean, I did the evidence collection, but the rest of the story really is due to Eleanor.
Nothing happens without a good prosecutor behind you, right?
Yeah. And as you know, and we had the great pleasure and honor of knowing people like Bob Anderson and John Webb and Eleanor Colborne, you know, I think the three greatest wildlife attorneys that the U.S. has ever had in my view.
Well, I'll tell you, Eleanor definitely, on one of my cases that stalled, Eleanor definitely made things happen. You know, she helped us get a really bad wanted fugitive back from Mexico. If it wasn't for her, we wouldn't have gotten him back. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So Eleanor, I basically reached out to Eleanor and got her involved through the assistance of other attorneys that I knew. And, you know, we were kind of at our wit's end. You know, we had tried essentially 8 years of trying to get compliance voluntarily and trying to work with them and trying to, you know, just get compliance, and compliance meaning that they would do all of the minimization, which would be shielding all the lights and then lowering the lines or whatever needed to be done with the power lines. But there's always going to be some level of take in these sorts of situations. So they have to mitigate for that. Right. And that means they have to do some kind of conservation project that ideally compensates for the unintentional take.
Right. And so it's going to make more baby shearwater somewhere else to allow for this certain number that's likely to be killed on the island. Yeah. Okay.
Makes perfect sense.
But they don't want to do it.
Yeah. And what that means. They say that they did. But the clear decision was delay, you know, I mean, became clear to me.
Yeah. Well, they said it to your face, right? They said it to your face. They had a strategy. They're going to outlast you.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty, you know, when you're looking at it, when you're an investigator and you're doing a case and somebody says that to you, translation is, I'm fine violating the law.
Yeah.
And that's a stupid thing to say to a federal agent.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay, so you get Eleanor on board, and what happened? What kind of charges? Who was charged? How did it play out?
So then Eleanor said, you know, we need, even though we were looking at misdemeanors, right? The Endangered Species Act is a misdemeanor. As is the Migratory Bird Treaty Act in this sort of scenario, and, you know, there's no trafficking going on where we can't engage the Lacey Act and stuff like that.
No smuggling.
She said, you know, even though this is a misdemeanor, we really want the eyes of a grand jury on this. So we took it to a grand jury. And the grand jury returned a true bill against the power company. So we indicted the power company, and about 2 months. So basically we were preparing for trial, as I recall.
Let me interrupt you one more time, Keith. Just so in case listeners do not know what a grand jury is, in the federal and state system, a grand jury is basically people from the community who are called up just like you would be for jury service, but you serve on a grand jury for a while, and prosecutors present basically their case, or an agent comes in, testifies, and a prosecutor presents what they've got. And then it's up to the grand jury members whether or not they agree to charge. It's not, again, another example of you going the extra mile not to be that heavy-handed fed, right? You're going to let and these are grand jury members from Hawaii, yeah?
Yeah.
And they heard the case, and they thought there was enough evidence to charge both companies or just the one?
So that was against, it was really two cases, one against the power company and one against the county.
The county,
And as you and I have seen so much over our career, when we got the indictment against the power company, 2 months later, the county came knocking on our door.
Of course they did. Yeah, they saw the handwriting on the wall. Yeah.
Yeah. And they did. But the one thing I do want to say, you know, is especially for the county, I mean, they were great people. You know, I mean, they were basically looking to fix the problem, you know.
Right.
And I think initially, you know, in the beginning of this 10-year period, first there's this hurdle of convincing them that they're actually violating a law, you know, because they're just lighting the community and they're
Yep.
just, you know, delivering power and things like that. But it's kind of getting them over that hurdle of, okay, yeah, we understand that, you know, we are causing this, and then, you know, therefore we are responsible. Now what do we do about it? So I often have gotten along better with some of my violators than I have with a lot of my colleagues and attorneys.
And when you say colleagues, you mean chain of command people, right? That don't necessarily see the,
Exactly. So I really do want to, you know, acknowledge the county employees and the mayor of that time and those folks, and then some of the people within the power company as well, because they, you know, they ultimately did do the right thing, but we just had to, you know, had to do the arm
Sometimes you do. You have to be the heavy hand in the room. So they're indicted. They're char well, the power company's charged. The
twist.
county sees the handwriting on the wall, so they come to the table. What's the
Yeah.
outcome? What's the result after the charges are filed? Did you go to trial or anything?
No, they I think once the county settled with us in a plea agreement, so
They
they
did like a pre-indictment plea.
yeah
Sometimes
yeah
criminals will
that,
do
that's
that.
my
They
recollection.
know an indictment's coming, so they'll just say, "Hey, I'm willing to plead guilty if you don't indict me."
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. And then, of course, that put the pressure on the power company. You know, so then they, rather than go to trial, you know, were willing to do a plea agreement. So we did two different agreements. Let me see if I have. I think you have the indictments, or I mean the press releases. But basically, there were fines, you know, fines involved, restitution, and then probation, for both. So we didn't want to take their money for no purpose, you know, so we gave them almost symbolic fines. For organizations like this, you know, like I think we did a $15,000 fine, which would be the MBTA, you know, level of fine,
That's the cap,
where we could have really piled on, but what we wanted to do was apply what penalties there were into things like restitution, So they did. They funded several projects, I guess, that were aimed at conserving the birds. So what we kind of did in a way is we set up the plea agreements. And again, this is kind of the brilliance of Eleanor Colborne. We set up the plea agreements to essentially be what they should have done in an HCP anyway. You know,
And an HCP is
and
a
it
habitat
also
conservation
essentially.
plan.
Yeah, which at the end of the day is a permit to allow you to violate while you're mitigating for that violation. And so basically it meant funding predator-proof fences around some seabird colonies. And so because cats and dogs and things like on other islands, mongooses, they kill so many of these seabirds. The concept was if they could fence them out, and there is this works, it actually works. If they fence them out, then the colony will be producing so many young, it will compensate for the one that it will compensate beyond what they're taking, you know,
right.
With lights and power lines and things like that. And the reason that, that compensation is valid is because predators were wiping them out,
yep.
you know? And so without that intervention, you know, they'd be gone. And honestly, I've had seabird biologists and experts tell me that, you know, this is probably may end up resulting in possibly saving the species.
Wow.
Because they are being wiped out, you know, but we're at least having some postage stamp sized, you know, plots of land that are protected, and they're, you know, increasing within those. That's wow. the concept.
That's awesome.
And they also funded some trends. Yeah, and then they also funded translocations. One is called Nihoku, Nihoku. The cool thing, though, to me was, and this is something Eleanor and I worked out, was that we made it a requirement, part of their probation, that they had to train, this is the county I'm talking about, they had to train all of their employees, which was 1,344 employees. They had to train them on the importance of and the ecology and the cultural connection of these species. And I did some of those trainings myself.
Nice.
Which was pretty cool. And it was, you know, it's one of those deals. I'm glad for my special agent training, right? Because these are hostile audiences.
Exactly. They are hostile audiences. That's awesome, though. But and you know, that cultural connection be so important.
Absolutely. And it was cool because, you know, these were police, they were firefighters, they were bus drivers, they were janitors, they were county council members, it was the mayor, right. You know, all that kind of thing. And so I would go in and, you know, a lot of people would be like this, you know, yeah, sitting there with arms their arms crossed, folded yeah. And like, grumpy. You know, pissed off that they had to be there. Right. And by the end of it, you know, the whole demeanor would change because I told them these three things. We owe it to these shearwaters several things. One is the fact, like I described last episode, that they gave us soil. So yeah. everything we eat that is grown on these islands is directly related to these seabirds historically.
I love it.
Two, every fish we eat, which any kind of predatory fish, which are the tuna and the wahoo and the other predatory fish that we love to eat, we owe that to seabirds, and here's how. Even today, whether you're a sport fisherman in Hawaii or a commercial fisherman, the way that you find tuna with all of our technology, the way you find tuna is you see what they call a pile of birds on the okay. on the ocean. And those birds are seabirds, shearwaters and petrels.
Okay.
And so what you see is a flock of birds, and what's going on is that the tuna are under the surface of the ocean, right. and they're chasing bait fish, like a wolf pack, more or less. And then they push the bait fish up to the surface, and then the seabirds see that, and they come, and they're congregating. And then we see the seabirds. Mm-hmm. So what's going on is that the tuna basically are revealing their location by driving up the bait fish, the small fish, to the surface. The seabirds then see them and come, and we see the seabirds, and then we go and we fish. So when we bring in, you know, yellowfin tuna or ahi, and when we bring in ono or wahoo, you know,
thanks to the birds,
that's all due to seabirds. Yeah. Yeah. And then the third thing is, the Hawaiian people almost assuredly discovered Hawaii on their first voyage from elsewhere in Polynesia by seabirds,
right.
because it's these millions of seabirds that are flying to and from the island. And, you know, I've spoken with Polynesian navigators, Nainoa Thompson being the great example. And he said, you know, we can get, using the stars and using our traditional methods of navigation, we can get within a couple hundred miles of the island. by crossing thousands of miles of ocean. But he said that last 150 miles is crucial.
And, no kidding. You're going to miss.
And that's when they start looking for other cues, like in addition to clouds and things like that. But a lot of it is seabirds. And because these very same species that are moving toward the island before sunset are traveling across the ocean and then coming to land. And that's what they would get their final vector off of, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome.
And then one other thing.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
No.
One other thing is that the Hawaiian people themselves used to more or less ranch these species for food. So they come back to the same spot. So reliably, Hawaiians could know that every year at the same time in this area of forest or area of cliff, there's going to be eggs that we can collect. And then after a few months, if we come back at a different date, there's going to be big fat chicks that we can collect and eat.
Right.
And so, so literally Hawaiians have the DNA of seabirds in their bones, you know?
Well, you know, that's a great example of, you know, you help people understand the why and it's a lot easier to make cooperation, but you know, kudos to you for going to that extra effort. I think one of the most telling things you ever said to me about this case and how you knew you made a difference is, tell us about what it was like to be on that island at night at the beginning of your investigation versus at the end, 10 years later.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me of that. You know, the very first time I went to Kauai in about 2001 or two, somewhere in that neighborhood, there was a light aura over the island. You know, if you stood back at the beach and then you looked, you could just see over the, especially over the towns, but the whole island kind of glowed in the sky. And at the end of this investigation, after the shielding of all the streetlights and after the shielding of the stadiums and the tennis courts and everything, you could see the stars again, like really well. And that was, I remember seeing that in about 2012 or something and thinking, wow, you know, that's because of me.
How often does light pollution go down, right? Never. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So I want, you know, we're almost out of time for today. I want to make sure I do mention though, that as a result of this case, you know, so much effort on your part, so much success in getting cooperation from not just the community, but the businesses and, you know, the county and the power company there in Hawaii, and working so well with the biologists at the service and the prosecutors at the U.S. Department of Justice, you know, you ended up getting what's called the Conservation Champion Award from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And that is a very prestigious award. You're a very humble guy. You like to give credit to other people. But I'll tell you, when that came out, there is no record of any special agent ever receiving the Conservation Champion Award from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a whole, right? And that is a very, very impressive accomplishment that I am just, I'm just in awe of. And I think, you know, well-deserved, obviously. But, you know, I think it speaks a lot to what you did on this case and just how you carried yourself in general as a special agent during your career. So, you know, on behalf of a guy who loves wildlife and the Hawaiian Islands, you know, thanks for everything you did on this. I can't believe you did it alone. They should have had four or five agents, including me, over there to help you. I would have liked to do that. Anyway, Keith, awesome case. I'm proud to be a colleague of yours and a friend of yours. And, I really, really appreciate you coming on to talk to us about it. It's a different type of law enforcement, but it's just an amazing case. Good job.
Oh, thanks. And thanks to you for this. I think this is cool and much needed. You know, we've always been kind of muzzled during our careers.
Fish and Wildlife does not do a good job of telling its own story, but you know, I take it that means you'll be on another episode.
I'd love to be.
Fantastic. Awesome. All right. Thanks, Keith. I appreciate you being on the show. This is Nature Secret Service. Special thanks to the crew here at California State University at Dominguez Hills in Carson, California. We'll see you next time. Nature Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturesecretservice.com.